Long before COVID happened, there were alarm bells raised about the harm that privatization of essential and public services would do in the long run. We've been seeing it for decades, as governments around the world have caved in to the idea that the private sector can always do things better. It's a bold premise and one that is accepted as truth by many economists. What the COVID crisis did was expose the harm that this economic theory has done to our society. We've seen it most clearly by looking at how the private sector ownership of nursing homes has put profits before people. And as a result, people have died. Today's program is a panel discussion by the Canadian Labour Congress on the impact of privatization. It's a topic that the CLC and other progressive organizations have been discussing for decades. The rampages of privatization is not new. What is new is that it's clearer now more than ever what the results of decades of corporate control of institutions which should be in public control has done. The CLC has released a new report on privatization called For the Public Good, the growing threat of privatization and workers' proposals to protect our future. In this discussion, panelists discuss how we can work together to strengthen public services. It was held on July 28, 2020. It's moderated by Amira Al-Gawabi, the Director of Communications for the CLC. She's joined by Emily Norgang, Senior Researcher at the CLC, who worked on the task force, Amanda Weiss, Senior Research Officer of CUPE, and Andrew McNeil, National Representative of the National Union of Public and General Employees, also known as NUPGE. Here's Amira Al-Gawabi to introduce the panelists.
So I'd like to recognize that myself and all of our webinar participants are here on the unceded Algonquin territory of the Anishinaabe people. Now, as we weather the COVID-19 pandemic, the importance of our public sector and public services has never been clearer. Public sector workers have kept the day-to-day foundation of our communities strong. Public sector workers have been on the front line of the pandemic in countless ways. We immediately think of our healthcare workers who are caring for the sick, elderly, and other vulnerable people in hospitals, long-term care facilities, and in people's homes. Public health experts continue to provide us with the best advice on how to stay safe as public scientists and researchers are working to help develop a vaccine. Public sector workers are cleaning and sanitizing facilities. They're collecting our waste. They are making sure that our drinking water is safe. They are inspecting our food and transport systems. Public sector workers are operating transit to keep our cities and communities functioning. They are keeping homeless and women's shelters open, supporting people with mental health issues and women and children who have to flee violence. Now, as 3 million Canadians lost their jobs, public sector workers moved at an unimaginable speed to design and implement the Canada Emergency Response Benefit to make sure people could pay their bills and put food on the table. Now, while the crisis has brought to light the important day-to-day work of our public sector, often going unnoticed, it has also exposed the damage done by years of government underfunding, budget cuts, deregulation and privatization, and that's why you're here today. Now, our critical public services and facilities are under growing pressure, including from corporations and from the financial sector's drive for profit. The shameful and heartbreaking state of long-term care is a result of decades of budget cuts and privatization that have placed a downward pressure on costs, harming both workers and residents. This ongoing tragedy confirms what unions and care workers have been saying for decades. The sector is clearly in crisis. Now, unfortunately, our response to the pandemic itself has not been immune from privatization. The government of Canada chose to contract out $5 million worth of PPE distribution contract to Amazon instead of Canada Post. This happened even though we were hearing reports detailing Amazon's horrendous working conditions, attempts to bust unions, and the use of tax havens and the firing of whistleblowers. The government's very controversial decision to contract out the administration of the Canada Student Service Grant to the We Charity Foundation is another blatant example of what happens when we privatize services rather than keeping them in-house with our talented and experienced federal public servants. And like other privatization schemes, this decision meant that the public would have paid far more than if the program was kept in-house. And like those privatization schemes, links between those benefiting from the agreement and the politicians who chose to take the privatization route is unfortunately far too common. So a webinar to explore the threats of privatization and importance of keeping our public sector strong could not be more timely. So last month, the CLC's Task Force on New Forms of Privatization released its report for the public good. Today, we're very lucky to be able to hear from some of the members of the Privatization Task Force. So first, we'll be hearing from CLC's senior researcher, Emily Norgang, who will discuss the findings of the task force's report. Emily's most recent research focuses on privatization and public services, regulating new forms of work, precarious work, and the gig economy. She also sits on the steering committee of the Canadian Network on Corporate Accountability and has recently joined the board of Canadians for Tax Fairness. Next, after that, we'll be able to hear from Canadian Union of Public Employees, CUPE, Senior Research Officer and National Health Care Researcher, Amanda Weiss, who will share insights on the impact of privatization on long-term care. CUPE represents 700,000 members in a variety of sectors, including 65,000 members who work in long-term care homes across Canada as care aides, licensed practical nurses, and dietary cleaning and clerical staff. Prior to CUPE, Amanda worked for 7 years in two long-term care homes in Ontario. And finally, we'll be hearing from Andrew McNeil, a national representative with the National Union of Public Employees, NUPGE, who will help us dive deeper into one of the newest forms of privatization, social impact bonds. Andrew researches public policy issues such as taxation and has worked extensively on privatization. He also sits on the board for Canadians for Tax Fairness. So without further ado, I'm very happy to pass it on to Emily.
Thanks, Amira, and welcome to everyone who's joining us today. It's really great to be here today and to take this time to talk about protecting our public services. As Amira said, I've worked with the CLC Task Force on New Forms of Privatization, and this task force was struck at the 2017 CLC convention. And at this time, you know, unions from across the country decided that we needed concerted action to address ways that privatization schemes were shifting and evolving, and how these new schemes are undermining our public sector, but also contributing to precarious work across the country. So first, I'd like to just extend an enormous thank you to all of the people, the members, the contributors who took part in the task force work, especially to those at PSAC, NUPGE, CUPE, PIPS, CUPW, the Society of United Professionals, and the PEI Federation of Labor. So through our work, we really confirmed some old truths about the impacts of privatization, but also monitored how new projects, how certain players in both government, the private sector, and finance, have been finding new ways of disguising privatization and are developing new profit off of services that at one point were previously seen as unprofitable. So I think most people joining us today are aware of the downsides of privatizing our public services, as many auditor generals, economists, service providers, workers, and unions have really shown us time and again. Privatization, it leads to higher costs for government, it's lowered the quality and compromised the safety of our services and infrastructure, it's lowered wages and working conditions, it's increased inequality, inequality not just by creating more precarious jobs, but also reducing access to those, especially equity-seeking groups who are using these services. And this has fallen disproportionately on women and racialized workers. And finally, privatization means less transparency and a loss of control and lack of accountability. So why do governments continue to privatize our programs and projects despite all of these well-documented impacts? You know, there's a lot of reasons. It allows governments to push costs down the road, and accounting rules allow them to present false savings, even though we're actually paying more. Often politicians who choose these schemes will also serve to profit, either politically, personally, or financially off of the programs. And there's also a huge industry behind privatization, with a very strong lobby. So this is, you know, consulting firms, banks, auditors, investors who all serve to profit off of privatizing our public services. So what we're seeing now is as the public becomes increasingly aware of these negative impacts, these same players who want to continue to profit are finding new ways or even jargon just to disguise privatization. QB, they've produced a fantastic piece on this, and I'll ask somebody to share the link in the chat function there where you can read more about some of these ways that privatization is being disguised. But these new forms are also the result of growing financialization. So what this essentially means, what financialization describes, is the process by which financial players have gained an unprecedented influence over our daily lives. More and more, the future of our jobs, the value of our homes, the nature of our communities, they're all subject to the ups and downs of financial markets and ultimately the choices of large investment funds. One way this is played out is through our pensions. Our pension funds and retirement savings, they do tie us very personally to financial markets. And what we're seeing is that in some cases, workers' pension funds may be investing in the very risky and problematic privatization projects that we're opposing. So this was one of the very tough questions that the task force looked at. And what we're finding is that unions across the country are taking a variety of approaches to this. One example is that, you know, QP is encouraging members to take actions that could prevent future investments in privatized infrastructure. Another very recent example from just a few weeks ago, following deaths at a long-term care facility, the long-term care facilities, many of them run by Rivera, PSAC called for PSP investments to divest from Rivera. So these types of approaches are absolutely essential, but alone, they're going to be limited. So the task force did identify that there's certainly a need for a broader debate on these very complex issues. Financialization, it's also facilitated the ability of private players to profit off of the services that were previously seen as unprofitable. So it's fairly clear why a private enterprise would want to purchase a public road or utility. It can charge fees and turn a profit. But what we're increasingly seeing is the privatization industry finding new ways to profit off of essentially our society's most vulnerable. So in Canada, we're seeing the use of social impact bonds for services like at-risk youth, for the homeless, for those suffering from addiction. And Andrew McNeil is going to speak more to this in a minute, so I won't spend too much time here. Another important element to these new forms of privatization are the three new government bodies that have been recently created to pursue and facilitate privatization. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Canada Infrastructure Bank. It was created in 2017 in response to the dire need to upgrade Canada's infrastructure, but rather than relying on the lower cost public financing, the CIB is mandated to attract private financing for these types of projects. Right now, we're at a really interesting point because despite recent revelations around the CIB's executive kickbacks and issues with transparency and accountability, again, the federal government is continuing to promote the CIB's role in our economic recovery. So this is something we're going to have to watch very, very closely. A second body is FinDev Canada. This was also created in 2017, and it was created to facilitate the export of Canada's financial services and private sector into the global south. It came alongside a new Financial Assistance Act, and together what these did was really embed and commit Canada to blended financing, and it really represents a serious shift that allows private sector interests to drive the direction of our international assistance and to push privatization to countries around the world. And then finally, we have the Social Finance Fund. It was announced in 2018, and this fund really sets the stage for increasing the use of social impact bonds. So what's interesting is that the creation of these three bodies, it doesn't just facilitate privatization, but they really formally embed these motives into government legislation and policy. So I'll just say, I'm running short on time here, that the final point that I just wanted to highlight is that the task force report also looked at the role of the public sector in meeting some key targets, one of them being climate change targets and transitioning to a green and sustainable economy. What is becoming crystal clear is that the current focus on market-based low-carbon investments is not just proving insufficient to leverage the level of capital we need, the level of investment we need to make this transition, but it also fails to ensure democratic and universal access to energy. So instead, we really have to be focusing our climate change strategy on public ownership, on democratic control, and on really rebuilding the capacity of public institutions and energy networks. You know, as we talk about the need for fiscal stimulus to help our economy recover, there's a lot to make these investments in a green economy. Doing so would strengthen the public sector, it would create thousands of decent new jobs, and it would really provide opportunities to young and racialized workers and other groups who have been hit particularly hard by layoffs. So we really are at a tipping point here. As Amir said, the pandemic hasn't just brought to light the importance of the public sector, but also what years of deregulation and privatization has done. And as you also mentioned, we're already seeing the government choose the privatization route in its response. Despite these moves in the wrong direction, it's not too late to change course. And to really call on the government to take this historic opportunity to engage in large-scale public projects, to invest in social infrastructure and socially useful jobs. The opportunities are there, we just have to take them. So I'll leave it at that for now. I encourage you all to review the report's recommendations, and I hope we can, you know, dive deeper into them in the Q&A period. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Emily. So next, Amanda Weiss, again from the Canadian Union of Public Employees, the Senior Research Officer and National Healthcare Researcher. So please go ahead, Amanda.
Thanks, Amira. And first, I'd like to thank the CLC for inviting me to participate in this webinar to talk about privatization and long-term care. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought unprecedented attention to long-term care as a result of the horrific rate of infections and deaths among long-term care residents and staff. What factors have resulted in the high mortality from COVID-19 in long-term care? There is no singular answer to this question. Factors include a shared workforce between homes, the structural design of homes, the rate at which management recognized the need to implement containment measures, and the capacity of homes to provide adequate PPE and testing. In Ontario, Amy Sue has found that when it comes to the odds of experiencing an outbreak in a long-term care home, geography matters more than ownership status. In rural communities, the profit status of a home did not matter in relation to a home's outbreak status. In urban communities, however, for-profit homes have a higher probability of experiencing an outbreak. These are population-dense regions and areas where for-profit home density is also higher. In addition, staff travel on public transit from home to home, also contributing to higher rates of COVID-19 transmission in city centers where staff work at multiple sites. Amy's research is supported by a recent article published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, which similarly found that in Ontario, quote, for-profit status is associated with the extent of an outbreak of COVID-19 in long-term care homes and the number of resident deaths, but not the likelihood of outbreaks, end quote. This study found that, quote, differences between for-profit and non-profit homes are largely explained by older design standards and chain ownership. However, long before the onset of the pandemic, research showed that for-profit homes are more prone to closure, focused on profits rather than quality care, have lower staffing levels, more verified complaints, more transfers to hospitals, and higher rates of pressure ulcers and morbidity. My talk today draws on the work of Dr. Pat Armstrong and her edited volume, The Privatization of Care, The Case of Nursing Homes. In her work, Pat outlines six forms of privatization in long-term care that must be unpacked. The first form is private ownership. This refers to the ownership of long-term care homes by corporate chains like Revera, Sienna, Extendicare, and Chartwell, but also companies like Sodexo that provide services that are contracted out from homes, such as laundry, housekeeping, and food services. It also refers to the for-profit companies that manage both non-profit and publicly owned homes. The second form is the privatization of the costs of long-term care. Residents of long-term care are charged an accommodation fee. Fees are provincially regulated and differ between jurisdictions. Whether a resident lives in a basic, semi-private, or private room also impacts how much they'll pay. Where a resident lives impacts how much they'll pay, and how much money they have will impact the quality of the accommodations they can access. The privatization of costs also refers to the hiring of a private companion by a family member to supplement the care provided to a resident by the home staff. When homes lower staffing levels, they shift the costs of care onto residents and families. For those who can afford it, they hire private caregivers to make up for inadequate care levels. In addition, because our governments aren't providing the services people need to live independently in their own home, more people are moving into retirement residences when a bed in a long-term care home isn't available, for which they pay even heftier amounts out of pocket. The third form of privatization is seen in managerial strategies taken from the corporate sector. Pat argues, quote, managerial practices taken from the business sector are designed for just enough labor and for making a profit, rather than for providing good care. These include paying the lowest wages possible and hiring part-time, casual, and those defined as self-employed in order to avoid paying benefits or providing other protections. These strategies are a primary way of controlling workers and what happens in a home. Racialized and women workers feel the impacts most deeply. The fourth form of privatization is responsabilization and work shifting. This form of privatization makes people living in long-term care homes increasingly responsible for their own care. It involves the transfer of care duties to unpaid labor, which is mostly performed by women. We see this when families take care work home when it isn't done or done well, such as laundry. We also see this when work is performed by volunteers in the home, such as helping to feed residents. Care is no longer viewed as a collective duty, but an individual responsibility. The fifth form of privatization is decision-making behind closed doors. There's little democratic accountability among corporate homeowners as decisions are increasingly made behind closed doors in the name of promoting and protecting competition. This also refers to the difficulty we have finding information related to company profits and who sits on a company's board. The final form of privatization is the privatization of our minds. This is characterized by a shift in what the public accepts as common sense, including the ideas that we have to accept austerity, we have to make cuts, and we can't make needed public investments in long-term care because we can't afford it. The 2002 Romanow Commission made clear that the extent and nature of our healthcare system is a matter of values. As Pat argues, quote, currently, the state of nursing homes and the number of beds available suggest we do not highly value older people or the growing number of younger people who are now in nursing homes or those who provide their care. At least, we do not value them enough to ensure they have the conditions and care they need. So, what must we do to fix the problems the sector faces? We must bring long-term care into the public health system and regulate it under the Canada Health Act. We need dedicated and adequate funding for long-term care through the Canada Health Transfer. We need to implement and enforce national standards of care and tie the standards to funding. We must create good, full-time jobs with higher wages and paid benefits. we must eliminate the for-profit ownership of homes and the contracting out of facility services. And we must use public funds to build more publicly operated long-term care homes. Private corporations and shareholders should not profit from people's medical needs, and governments should never put our healthcare up for sale. Thank you, and I look forward to responding to questions you may have.
Thank you so much, Amanda. Really appreciate that. And next, we're going to hear from Andrew McNeil, again, a national representative with the National Union of Public Employees, NUPG. Please go ahead, Andrew.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to the CLC for organizing this. What's been in the news lately is, as Emily mentioned, what's been happening with the WE charity. It's very appropriate that to be talking about social impact bonds when the WE charity is getting so much publicity from the attempt to use it to privatize the Canada Student Service Grant. In both cases, what we're looking at is an attempt to take something that was originally meant to do good and turn it on its head by using it for privatization. In the case of WE, it's using charities to privatize public services. In the case of social impact bonds, it's using social finance to privatize public services. Social finance was originally the idea that investors in private or nonprofit enterprises would accept a lower return on investment to accomplish social, environmental, or community economic development objectives. With social impact bonds, that reverses it. Instead of helping the vulnerable, the goal becomes making a profit from them. In Canada, we're already seeing social impact bonds being used by the federal government and by provincial governments in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. In addition to what Emily mentioned, we're seeing social impact bonds used for employment and skills training, public health, and child welfare. Now, I'll talk first about the way social impact bonds are supposed to work. Normally, you're told if you don't if what I'm saying makes no sense, then let me know. In this case, if what I'm saying makes no sense, it probably means you're getting a good understanding of how social impact bonds are supposed to work, because it's not terribly logical. So in theory, and I emphasize again, this is in theory, what is supposed to happen is that investors and governments are supposed to enter into contracts where investors fund services that have the potential to save governments money. These contracts include objectives that service is supposed to meet and how the performance of the service will be measured. How the service is delivered is not supposed to be part of the contract. That's a decision made by the investors or by the intermediary group they're working with. Investors get the capital back with an agreed upon profit, but only if the targets for the service are met. If the targets aren't met, investors use their original investment, lose them all their money. That's the theory. Now, others involved in social impact bonds are the intermediary organizations who put together the team of the investors, the service providers, and others, the agencies actually delivering the services, and those involved in negotiating contracts and measuring the results to see if the targets have been met. Control of the services funded using social impact bonds rests with intermediary groups or investors. In practice, there are quite a few problems that the privatization industry doesn't like to talk about. The need to pay for investor returns, the need to pay for intermediary organizations, and the cost of contract negotiations mean that there's a lot. Social impact bonds push up the cost of services by a lot. For the first federal government social impact bond project, less than 40% of the funding went to frontline services. Over 60% went for the cost of administering the social impact bond project. Now, because investors stand to lose all their money if the targets aren't met, there's a huge temptation to game the system. Investors have managed to have the results of social impact bond projects measured in ways that make them look far more successful than they actually are. When participants for social impact bond projects are selected, it's very common for those who are least likely to succeed to be screened out. So for one project in Saskatchewan to increase high school graduation rates, The school they picked was one that cannot accommodate students with severe behavioral problems or special needs, which right away means that the people who are most likely to have trouble completing high school have just been screened out. Even when the system is gamed, governments often have to provide subsidies for social impact bonds or guarantee investments. And we're seeing this with the Social Finance Fund, that based on the description of the type of projects it will be funding, it looks like a lot of the money is going to go to subsidize social impact bonds. For organizations delivering community and social services, they're struggling for funds. So it's not a surprise that some are desperate enough to try and get funding from social impact bonds. But what those organizations find is that because investors or intermediary organizations are in control, those delivering the service can end up doing things that undermine their mission and conflict with their values. A particularly notorious example is an organization that was meant to be helping the homeless in London, in Britain, that found itself instead helping get people deported so they could meet the targets for a social impact bond. The way social impact bonds are promoted is based on lies and myths. What we often see is the privatization industry portraying social impact bonds as free money. They ignore the extra costs. They ignore the fact investors want to be repaid. The privatization industry claim that governments are throwing money at social problems, ignoring the billions that have been cut from community and social services. They claim that governments only have to pay for services if targets are met, ignoring the millions spent on subsidies, loan guarantees, and the way the system is gamed. And even though social impact bonds give investors and intermediary groups control over how services are delivered, the privatization industry is still trying to claim that social impact bonds aren't really privatization. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for a lot of that detail. And I'm so happy that all of you are looking at these types of issues, because most certainly they are indeed very complex. So it is really important for folks to be able to access the kind of research that has been put into this new report on privatization, and to look at this really important work. So thanks to all of our panelists for their very important presentations. And we already are receiving some questions from our participants today. The first question comes to us from Madeleine Bert Dagnilio, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's for Amanda. She's asking whether evidence that public transit was increasing the exposure to the coronavirus in long-term care homes. So it seems that she heard that this might be the reason for the increased exposure. And she's asking, is this speculation, or is there any evidence to demonstrate that that was indeed a factor?
Thanks so much for the question. So I don't know specifically if travel by public transit has had a direct role in increasing the rates of transmission of COVID-19. The information that I do have comes from a webinar I attended, wherein Amy Sue talked about the research she has recently been conducting. And she just pointed out that one of the reasons why we would not be particularly surprised that infection rates are higher in urban and city centers is because staff travel via public transit between work sites. So whether those individuals who travel by transit are becoming infected through transmission on a vehicle per se, or whether they're picking it up elsewhere in the community or through the home in which they work, and then possibly themselves unwittingly transmitting it by touching a surface or leaving droplets in a vehicle that is part of the transit system, that still remains unknown.
Thank you so much, Amanda. So a question I think for Emily that many people might be wondering is, when we're seeing, you know, significant deficits, when we're, you know, hearing from some quarters of society talking already about austerity, how do you respond to those types of calls that say, you know, it's going to eventually be all about belt tightening, not about investing in public services? How do you respond to that kind of claim, Emily?
Yeah, thanks for the question. And it's definitely one that we've heard a lot. People are asking this question. I'd say first off, although there has been a lot of hype about the projected federal deficit, our debt to GDP ratio is actually quite good. We're doing much better than we were in the 90s. And right now we're actually doing much better than many of our G7 counterparts. So right now, interest rates are the lowest they've been since World War II. So it's not a time for austerity. It's the time for governments to be thinking about investing and spurring economic growth. And really one of the best ways to do this is through investing in our public sector and public services, taking advantage of these low interest rates and ramping up these services that have become so vital, or apparently being seen to be so vital during this pandemic, when they've always been vital, but often invisible before. So we need to be investing in these public services. And, you know, hiring more public sector workers not just benefits the services, but it actually benefits the economy and helps support a strong and diverse middle class. There was a recent study put out by IRIS, and then it was picked up by PSAC, and it showed that for every dollar that we invest in federal public service jobs, it actually generates $1.77 in Canada's economy. So I'd say that's the first point to remember. We're doing well, and investing in the public sector will help us do better, will help grow the economy. I'd say the second point is, if we're talking about choosing between keeping services in-house and privatizing them, as we've heard, privatizing does not save money. It costs more down the road. So it's about investing in a way that we're expanding and strengthening our public services and infrastructure. And then finally, I'd also say that we need to be thinking about expanding government revenue, and fighting for tax fairness is one of the best ways we can do this. Just last week, Canadians for Tax Fairness released a report showing the amount of money that Canadian corporations are hiding in offshore tax havens. And this amount, it amounted to $381 billion in 2019. So that's higher than the federal deficit. And Canada loses between $10 and $25 billion a year due to tax havens. So this is absolutely appalling. You know, not only have corporations benefited from the very low corporate income tax rates, but then they benefit a second time from getting these lucrative government contracts, and then they benefit a third time from avoiding taxes and then further starving the government of the revenue it needs. So I'd say, you know, provincial and federal governments really need to restore and increase fairness in our tax system. This includes increasing taxes on the wealthiest Canadians and corporations, and really closing unfair and ineffective tax loopholes. Keeping services in-house, fighting for tax fairness, this is really two of the best ways we can increase government revenue and support and strengthen our public services. And so really all levels of government need to commit to public financing and public investment at this time more than ever.
And this one is for all of the panelists, and we'll start with Andrew. James Infantino is asking, can panelists discuss the specific options available to pension funds, particularly jointly trusted pension plans, in challenging the privatization of public services? So Andrew, and then the other panelists on that.
That's a good point. And it's not easy because, once you get, there has to be agreement from management as well, or from both enough trustees, a majority of trustees, to get new policies put in place. I know that when the Newfoundland and Labrador public sector pension plan moved to joint trusteeship, because it was starting up, they were able to get rules in place that do place some restrictions on investment in P3s. Otherwise, I think the best, what people probably have to do if they're looking at changing rules, is point to some of the problems of privatization. That P3s are often portrayed as a fail-safe investment. As we're seeing, they're not. They have been known to go bust. If the other thing about privatization schemes is there's reputational risk, as the public service pension plan has found out with Rivera, And a final aspect, depending on where people are investing, is a change of government. A lot of Canadian pension funds have invested in privatized infrastructure in Britain. Another 3 or 4% vote difference in the 2017 election, the Labour Party would have been elected with a majority, and their plan was to renationalize a lot of the infrastructure owned by Canadian pension plans at the value of the assets, as opposed to the market value, which would have meant pension plans, again, could potentially have been compensated for a lower value than what they were paid for the asset. So that means, again, what looked like a good idea and a safe investment isn't.
I think Andrew really captured that well. You know, pension funds, they're increasingly large and important forces driving financial markets. And for a range of reasons, be it, you know, low interest rates, longer lifespans, low and uncertain investment returns, they are being pushed to hunt for more lucrative, but as Andrew said, they can be very risky investments. So this is, you know, real estate, hedge funds, private equity, and of course, infrastructure, the highways, ports, bridges, you know, marine ports, energy grids that are really the foundation of our society. So this is quite the risk. But as Andrew said, there's also growing evidence pointing to how risky these investments are. And although pension funds are going into them for this stability, they may not be that stable investment that they were once seen to be. I'd say in terms of kind of workers' response, I mentioned earlier, there's, you know, QP and PSAC, I gave two examples of really resisting their members, their pension plans investing in these privatization projects. There's also other ways that some unions are pursuing. So for cases where the projects have been privatized, requiring them to use community benefit agreements. So this could be a way to at least ensure that the jobs are decent, that they provide benefits, they could provide opportunity, training opportunities for local residents involved in the project. And then I'd also just kind of remind folks that we do have a lot of leverage here. You know, fewer than one in four workers in the private sector has access to a workplace pension plan, but more than 85% of public sector workers have a pension plan at work. And so in this context, we have a lot of leverage, a lot of power to be keeping our pensions out of, you know, these types of privatization. And as I said, at the same time, really need to be having a broader debate on why this is happening and other avenues we can do to be avoiding privatization. Because it is a very complex situation.
And just jumping off a point that Emily just made about sort of leveraging the power that we have at hand. So at no other point in time has long-term care had such sustained media attention, even throughout the Wetlaufer inquiry. So Elizabeth Wetlaufer is a nurse, a registered nurse in Ontario, who killed, I believe, 8 long-term care residents and was also found guilty of attempting to murder many more. Even that process, the inquiry, was a short blip on the media radar. You know, the inquiry produced a massive report. None of the recommendations have been implemented by the Ontario government since then. And there's sort of been a little bit of a very quick amnesia about the whole affair altogether. So the media spotlight that has been on long-term care throughout the pandemic has opened a really critically important opening, wherein I think a lot of folks who really knew very little, if anything at all, about the long-term care sector are learning a lot and are horrified to learn about all the systemic issues that underlie the sector. So I have been happy to read lots of letters to the editor in small local newspapers where individuals are writing in and saying, I own shares in a private for-profit long-term care company. I am so disgusted by what's going on. I had no idea that this was the case, and I am selling my shares. With the case of Revera and its ownership by the PSP, I suspect that a lot of members of the PSP similarly did not know where their investments through the PSP lie and didn't know that the fund owned Revera, and similarly probably were not aware of the issues that underlie the for-profit private home sector as well. So I'm hoping that if there is to be, you know, some silver linings out of this awful situation, that one of them is an increased awareness about pension investments in public services like long-term care, and an opportunity for folks who are members of those plans to put pressure, to ask questions and to raise pressure such that they might lead to the divestment of those holdings as well.
So thanks so much to all of you for those responses. I think the next question from Dominic Bellissimo, you know, can fit into, again, all of the issues you've each raised, but I'm thinking specifically, Amanda, maybe to start with you. Dominique is asking whether there are significant examples of privatized services being returned to public ownership, what he's calling maybe the re-municipalization of services, in other words. And I know that there has been, of course, the call for long-term care facilities to, you know, no longer be allowed to run as a for-profit institution. So I'm wondering, are there examples of that actually occurring? And perhaps, you know, add some words on, you know, what you expect from our provincial governments and federal government in terms of the long-term care issue.
Thanks, Dominique, and thanks, Amira. So there was a whole bunch of questions within that single question. So I will do my best to try to answer all of them. I don't have I'm not sure of examples where services of homes where services were previously contracted out that have been brought back in-house within a long-term care home. I myself worked in two different homes. Both of them were private nonprofits. In the first home that I worked in, all of our services were provided in-house. This included laundry, housekeeping, and food services. In the second home that I worked in, all of the services were contracted out. And to this day, you know, it's been, I think, 15 years since I worked in the sector. I still cannot wrap my mind around the fact that food would be prepared in a facility and then shipped up to the home on a truck and reheated in microwaves and placed in front of residents to eat, given how paramount food is to our daily lives. There was a couple of other questions packed in there around provincial and federal roles, I believe, in addressing the systemic issues related to long-term care. I hope that I'm understanding the question correctly, Dominique. So often in relation to QP's National Long-Term Care Campaign, we get folks who push back a little bit against the campaign and say that some of the actions that we're calling for are unrealistic because long-term care is a healthcare issue and therefore the sole prerogative of the provincial government. When I hear this from folks or see this in comments on our Facebook page, I realize that as part of the labor movement and as healthcare advocates, we still have a fair bit of work to do to educate the Canadian public about how our healthcare system works. So a lot of folks either don't realize or are confused by the fact that we have, you know, a Canada Health Act. We have the Canada Health Transfer. We used to have a Canada Health Accord. It expired. We should have another one again. So there is federal involvement in healthcare in Canada by setting the principles upon which our universal system of healthcare is based, and also through the provision of public funds to the provinces and territories to help pay for our healthcare services. Across Canada currently, long-term care is an iniquitous patchwork system of legislation and regulations. And there are no national standards for long-term care at all. So the province you live in will determine the amount and type of care that you'll receive and how much you're going to pay for it. Across Canada, some provinces have no legislation regarding hours of care. Some provinces have guidelines, which is sort of an aspirational goal that homes can strive to meet. And other homes do have legislated hours of care, but what is legislated falls far below what the evidence shows us is needed in order to maintain, if not optimize, resident care. So because of this iniquitous patchwork system and the fact that we've seen disastrous results across Canada, we have, you know, massive issues with recruitment and retention across Canada as well, it shows that the provinces can't address the systemic issues on their own, and that it is time for the federal government to step up to the plate and to help the provinces out to ensure that residents of long-term care, no matter where they live across the country, will receive the same type and amount of care. And if we are to continue with accommodation fees, that they will know that no matter where they live, they will be subject to the same fees for a bed in a long-term care home. So this idea that, you know, it's solely the prerogative of the provincial government is a myth that we need to overcome. And it is time for the federal government to step up and play a key leadership role.
So much, Amanda. Did any of the other panelists want to weigh in on the on any examples they may know of something that had been privatized, some type of service that had been transferred back into public service? Andrew, I'm seeing you're nodding.
No. A lot of the examples are municipal, particularly water systems and sewage systems. So generally, it's easiest to get services brought back under public control when people see the damage that privatization has done. And that's part of a larger pattern, which is the more familiar people are with the service, the more they're opposed to privatization. Probably the most notorious example is Conrad Black is opposed to prison privatization.
Hey, Emily, did you also want to weigh in there?
I would just add, thanks for the question, Dominique. There's an excellent report by the Transnational Institute that was released in 2019, and it describes 1,400 examples of where privatization was reversed worldwide. As Andrew said, a lot of these examples were at the municipal level. And then we're even seeing this, so the United Kingdom, which in a sense is referred to the birthplace of the privatization of social impact bonds, they're going through a major shift right now where they're bringing a lot of services back under public control. So examples include the operation of prisons, of probation services, of city councils bringing services back under public control. In some cases, the reason is because of cost. They simply find it's more expensive to privatize these services. In other cases, it's because of the quality of services. In the Birmingham prison, there was an increase in inmate violence, for example. In the U.S., we're also seeing cases across the U.S. where municipalities are bringing services again back in-house. New York City just brought their IT services back in-house because of cost savings, as one example. And then I'd also recommend checking out another study that explored 15 cases of remunicipalization in Canada. And in Canada, a lot of this was across some big cities and some small cities. So, you know, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Calgary, some of the bigger ones, and then, you know, Port Hawkesbury, Nova Scotia. And all of these cities and communities had decided to bring certain services back in-house. It could be snow removal, it could be wastewater treatment. And in these cases, the primary reason that they found was because of cost savings. It was just cheaper to keep it in-house. So I check out some of these studies, and it is inspiring to see that finally people are starting to see the light and that there is a lot of movement to bring these services back in-house.
Absolutely. And certainly that's a great place to kind of come to our conclusion of this webinar, that there is hope at the end of this tunnel. And so there you have it, a wonderful opportunity just to think about these really deep issues that do have impacts, both, you know, easily visible and not so visible.
You've been listening to a panel discussion by the Canadian Labour Congress held on July 28th about the growing threat of privatization. Panelists were Emily Norgang, Senior Researcher at the CLC, Amanda Weiss, Senior Research Officer at CUPE, and Andrew McNeil, National Representative for NUPGE. It was moderated by Amira El-Gawabi. Links to the report can be found in the show notes for the program if you'd like to read them yourself.
Sideways I slide through the square. I'm hoping so hard for a kiss from God. I miss the sweet love of the air. A silver chariot soars through Mercury ripples of sky. I'm looking so hard for a place to land. I almost forgot how to fly. So keep on moving, or stay by my side. Tell you a secret I've never revealed. However we are is okay.
To slow the spread of the virus, we need to press pause again. That's why once more, we need to stay home and avoid all non-essential travel. Gatherings are prohibited in red zones and are to be avoided in orange zones. And it's important to keep following the everyday health measures. Let's press pause again to curb the spread. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves properly. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Still looking for a holiday gift or two for the special people in your life? CKUT has new merch, including hoodies and t-shirts, that showcase classic designs dug up from our art attic. head to ckut.ca to discover our new merch store and find out more about sizing and shipping. Happy holidays from all of us at CKUT.
This is Democracy Now!
Four more years!
Now, if you want to really drive them crazy, you say 12 more years.
12 more years!
Because
how fascism works, the politics of us and them. We'll speak with Yale philosopher and scholar of propaganda, Jason Stanley. He says nations don't have to be fascists to suffer from fascist politics.
Trump is very clear that that loyalty to him is the only guide. Reality is, of course, the greatest threat to fascism, because fascism is based on power and reality is a way of responding to power. You say it's just false. So you have to make everyone destabilized, not connected to the truth, and you have to represent yourself as reality. And you have to show that you're stronger than reality, because fascism is about machismo and power.
Then, 50 years ago today, Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile. His former advisor, Ariel Dorfman, was dancing in the streets of Santiago. We'll look at the lessons he sees for today. And world-renowned anthropologist and activist David Graeber has died at the age of 59. He helped come up with the slogan, "We are the 99%. We'll feature part of our interview with Graeber just days after the 2011 launch of Occupy Wall Street.
People have to, like, go into their public squares, meet each other, start talking to each other, and start brainstorming of ideas. I mean, essentially the idea is the system is not going to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves. So we're going to try to get as many people as possible to camp in some public place and start rebuilding society as we'd like to see it."
All that and more coming up.